Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode, sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, we're recasting Nate's 2021 interview with Adam Steiner discussing Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by Adam Steiner, the author of Into the Never, Nine Inch Nails, and the Creation of the Downward Spiral. Adam, welcome.
Hello.
And so this was a really interesting book. We've talked about the distant past a lot on the show, but haven't done as much 90s, have done very little 21st century stuff. And Reznor, Trent Reznor, the main man, the sole entity creating the music in Nine Inch Nails, is very much a transitional figure from one millennium to the next.
Yeah. That's a really interesting perspective, because it's like he has that weird kind of Renaissance man of the 20th into the 21st century, as you say, where he crosses over between being a musician, but also kind of a sexual liberator in terms of the S&M aspects of his work. Weird kind of a style icon, sort of goth, but also industrial, and then kind of neo-industrial or post-industrial, if you like. And then obviously all of his work relating to like music and technology with soundtracking, studio innovation, and then working with, you know, the Beats headphones. So it's really weird how he's actually worked in lots of different mediums and not just as a musician.
Yeah, absolutely. And you... So you say that his greatest achievement is his greatest musical achievement is using the computer and studio as instruments in themselves, and that that prefigures the end of music as it was defined in the 20th century. Can you elaborate on what you meant by that?
Yeah, sure. I think it's quite a grandiose statement, isn't it? When I hear it read back to me, maybe I was overreaching, but let's see. Yeah, for me, it was just the fact that you went from the birth of rock and roll in the 50s, 60s, and then you went all the way through the phase of hard rock and so on in the 70s. Don't worry, I'm not going to go through every decade, but just by the time you come up to Trent Reznor and you know, the early 1990s, you've basically sort of had grunge, and then you've kind of like got what's next, and there's that weird pressure of like coming towards the millennium, and you know, what is our future music supposed to be? And I think the way in which he, you know, really pushed the idea of the studio as an instrument, but also not just produced the record, but did so much work around sound manipulation, and then found noise, ambient noise, of taking film samples and things, and then also just going straight out with like raw manipulation of instruments. So instead of perhaps saying, I will play a, you know, a straight chord progression on my guitar, it was more about, I will make some noises on my guitar that sound cool atmospherically and texturally for the kind of emotions I'm trying to evoke in this song. And then I'll take that piece of sound and manipulate it anyway in all kinds of strange ways, you know, pitching it down, making it slower, speeding it up twice as fast. And like that, I think that's sort of like, should we say, like wise interference just meant a really different kind of music than what you had going on at the time. Because it was quite a sort of, I think with the early 90s, it was quite a sort of back to basics era anyway, from the sheen and shine of the 80s. And then you are, we are now with, you know, well into the 21st century. And you have so much use of electronic production equipment, you know, basic things like Pro Tools and vocoders and things like that, and auto-tune. So the level of manipulation has almost kind of worked its way into music as an accepted fact. So I think that's a kind of like almost a sort of end of music thing, where so much of what we can do now is artificial anyway. Not necessarily in a bad sense, but the idea of a bunch of people playing in a room together as a four piece and just recording it raw and live is just, yeah, I just don't think it's necessarily accurate anymore.
And you got a great quote that kind of elaborates on this, that Reznor's considered application of music technology prefigured the coming crisis of overproduced manufactured music that reduced playing to inputting. And went far beyond the perfect and honest live take and preference of dragging and dropping sound and auto-tuning bad singers to idealize perfection. I mean, a lot of people like Rick Beato, the YouTube musicologist, say that rock and roll was killed by quantizing everything, you know, where they take Nickelback playing live in the studio and then they sort of reconstruct it digitally so that every drum beat is perfectly in sync and every bar is perfectly the same measure. And so what Reznor was doing was a lot more organic than that. And I think the way it survived when so much rock that came after it, although, you know, one of the other claims you make in the book is that Reznor destroyed, I think you're quoting somebody else saying that this album destroyed the idea of genres. But if you had to put Nine Inch Nails in a genre, it would be industrial / alternative. Like, he played basically live with a rock band, but when he recorded in the studio, he's doing, you know, one man band inspired by Prince and the application of technology, especially samples inspired by Public Enemy, the hip hop group. And obviously Human League was a big inspiration for him. You know, he says, you know, it wasn't the Sex Pistols for me, it was the Human League. And I was so excited by the idea that they did it all with computers and no human beings were involved. So kind of prefigured the corner we painted ourselves into, but still had the freedom of the era.
Yeah. I think a really interesting thing you mentioned there is the idea of it, you know, using a lot of machines and stuff, but it still sounds kind of organic. I think he talks about the idea of like, it still has a sort of human imprint, a bit of a heartbeat behind what he's doing. So it's using machinery, broadly speaking, you know, technology, electronic stuff, as opposed to the, you know, the element of the soul to make something that's still very emotive and human-like, that people can connect to. And I think that's, you know, one of the great validities of music, if it brings up an emotional response as opposed to, you know, bile. It's really, you know, it's what really gets to people and it stays with them perhaps, and they get that emotional resonance, that sense of connection. But what you said was really interesting there about the fact that it's you know, he's making stuff that still feels kind of organic. It feels kind of dirty and broken and messy and things. And that kind of fits into like the sort of post-industrial aesthetic of a lot of Nine Inch Nails stuff that's since become kind of a bit slicker, slightly more, I think, like digitized, kind of more, working more on like glitch art and things, which is great because it's like very contemporary and sort of reflects the times. But for a long time, it was very much about, you know, images of decay and like, you know, like pretty things like a butterfly or something crushed, made kind of dirty. And that is also carried through into the music. You know, sometimes the music's kind of like messed up and fucked up and it sounds kind of like crappy, but it's sort of, it's meant to sound like that. So he really kind of like literally breaks stuff down, or breaks it, if you like. And you get something like way more visceral from that. And I think that's what made him, like you said, a more of an alternative musician, more of a rock band than someone who was just producing, you know, Wham or something like that. All due respect to Wham, obviously.
Yes, definitely. Especially after Christmas having just passed, you got to respect Wham. But let's take a step back. I want to play our first song snippet, and this is kind of an obvious choice, but
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
This is Head Like a Hole from Nine Inch Nails' first album, Pretty Hate Machine. And that was Head Like a Hole, the hit single off of Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails' first album, Pretty Hate Machine. And that introduces our segment of where did this guy come from? Like, what's Trent Reznor's biography? He's from the deindustrialized Midwest.
Yes, yes. It's a really interesting backstory simply because of its plainness and its commonality. And I think that's something we forget, especially with a lot of American musicians, where we... In places like the UK and Europe, if we were to put our like pretentious hats on, do we ever take them off? We're in the old world over here. You guys, like, we kind of see America as obviously, you know, this vast big land of opportunity and money and shine and things like that and glamour. So we always kind of like jump between the East and West. We're like, oh, it's either like LA, California, or it's New York. And, you know, we're quite lazy. We kind of forget everything that's in between, which is, you know, millions and millions of people who don't live in those extreme kind of situations, but they're still the musicians that come out and make really extreme, intriguing, inspiring music. Reznor, from small farming town, Mercer, Pennsylvania. He made the common complaint that I think a lot of us would. I'm from a small village in England, in the Midlands. A lot of us would say the same sort of thing, where it's like, I'm from a small town, nothing ever happens there, no one ever came from there, there's no opportunities. It's not necessarily grim, it's not necessarily bad. He talks about like endless field of wheat and stuff. And in a way, you know, they think, oh, that's kind of cute, that's kind of nice. And then you also think, God, that also sounds really fucking dull. You know, what would happen to me and what happens if I stay there? You'd probably become a farmer. and that is your life. So you kind of value the wheat. But, you know, for some people, that's okay. That's what they want to do. And his really common complaint that Orson used me was, you know, he's like, oh, I don't want to like spend the rest of my life pumping gas, like wondering what I would do with myself. And like gas station attendant comes up. I think it's like his recurring nightmare of what might have happened if like he didn't actually latch on to music. And so he went over to Alhini College, I forget where it is, it might be Cleveland, did a little bit of like computer science.
I think it's Allegheny, actually.
Allegheny, thank you. Oh my God, yeah, I would never have got that. And, and he did some studying, which I think along with, you know, his classical piano training as a kid, not that he was like a child prodigy or anything, you know, kind of combined, and he was in like the school jazz band, I think, kind of combined to, you know, give him like rough, ready skills and intuitions of, you know, the possibilities of music. So he wasn't just some guy who like learned loud punk rock electric guitar in his bedroom. He, you know, already his like perspectives were slightly widened than that. And yeah, he went along to Cleveland in Ohio and was working as a dog body in what's called the Right Track Studios. And I love the stories about how the boss was like, oh, when he cleaned the floor, he really cleaned the floor. And, you know, he was basically like mopping and helping out and just, he once again, absorbed things, pick things up, eventually became a studio engineer, which is, you know, quite an involved role with lots of button pressing and stuff without the authority of the producer. And then he was, you know, he got like the nights of the studio to himself to work on his demos for what I think was quite a long time. And on the strength of those demos, you know, he got the deal with TVT, and that led to Pretty Hate Machine. So I think it's quite a sort of inspiring, not even rags to riches. It's just like, you know, someone making something of themselves and basically doing it all on their own. And you kind of see that line carried through. He's a really collaborative guy, obviously, given all the projects he's done. But yeah, from starting, he's basically like the one man auteur. So yeah, it's really impressive stuff.
Absolutely. And you left out, he did an apprenticeship as a keyboard player in a number of new wave bands and cover bands in the Cleveland area. And
you know, I was doing him a favor there.
Yeah.
I was kind of skipping over a bump in history.
Attempted that, you know, and failed. It's impressive that he shrewdly figured out that that was not how you're going to get places. And he, you know, gets the studio time very cleverly, hires a publicist, has this bidding war. And it's so funny that he ended up with TVT, because this was a record label that was very profitable, but really what they were known for, Steve Gottlieb, the head of that label, they put out TV's Greatest Hits, which was a set of CD sets, compilations of TV theme songs. So this wasn't somebody who's used to working with artists or cultivating careers. This was somebody who was very into shrewd calculations of what would make money. And he was right with Reznor. You know, I think Pretty Hate Machine went gold in its initial run, 300,000 the first couple of years, and then went gold shortly thereafter. But Gottlieb and Reznor never got along. In fact, Gottlieb called the first mix of that album an abortion. Talk about the contractual problems that Reznor got into with Gottlieb after that record came out.
Sure. So obviously, you know, a bit of friction with the abortion comment, not the kind of feedback you want to hear. It's really amusing. Even now, I think it's like, it's just this thing that Reznor's had to bury. And just not addressed, because I think it stirs up lots of stuff in him. And it's like a really difficult, it was a really difficult turning point when he's like, I'm trying to get my career going. And this, you know, this label guy is basically trying to control and manipulate me and like steer my creative direction. And all he really wants is someone to put up the money and help put the record out. And it's like, it's really strange because, you know, I think it started off well. And maybe the case is, as you say, TVT is such a weird label to even bother approaching or like going with. Maybe TVT was the only one that came back. I don't think there was a huge, from what I know, I don't think there was a huge bidding war, even though the band was considered very hot from like some of the live shows and stuff they were doing. It was still basically Reznor in the Right Track Studios, you know? So it's interesting how that came about. And I think that part of the schism was like Gottlieb like put a lot of money and effort. And there was multiple studios, like including sessions in London and then four different producers who I, to be blunt, I had to look up because they've done a lot of really cool, interesting stuff, but really different things. I think like Adrian Sherwood, John Fryer was one guy, and then two other blokes. So
Yeah, I can run through that. It was Adrian Sherwood, who's best known for U2 and New Order. Mark Flood Ellis was the guy from U2 and New Order. Adrian Sherwood was known for Ministry and Skinny Puppy, and those are the bands that are commonly seen as the biggest precursors of Nine Inch Nails, as quote unquote industrial bands, although they were both quite sonically less song-oriented and more edgy than Nine Inch Nails. Flood Ellis with New Order and U2, and also Depeche Mode. John Fryer from 4AD Records, This Mortal Coil, Depeche Mode, Cocteau Twins, and Keith LeBlanc, who was a drummer and played in Tackhead, but had come up actually playing on Sugar Hill Sessions back when rap groups like the Sugar Hill Gang would rap in front of a live band. So, and Trezor and drummers are always, that's the one instrument that he really never felt competent to play. So there's, if anybody's going to be playing on his records, it's generally a drummer. And you mentioned the live band. It's also, I think, important to mention right from the get-go, it's in the studio, it's Trezor solo. Live, it would either be a power trio, a Trezor on guitar, Reznor on guitar and a bassist and drummer, or add a keyboard and eventually added a second guitarist as well. So a 3 or 4 piece group with the sound man sometimes doing backing vocals, which is an interesting touch. And so there's this tension with Gottlieb, and then Reznor's work ethic is always inspiring, and immediately they were out on tours, headlining tours, but also open for Skinny Puppy, Jesus and Mary Chain, Peter Murphy, and it gets to the cycle that Reznor referred to as his life being that I'm a music creation performance machine. Talk about that and how that impacted Reznor's psychology.
Sure. I mean, I think... as you're saying, I think there was pressure from the record company for the record to perform, but also I think there was self-inflicted pressure as well. So obviously the common thing, and in some ways it still hasn't changed with music to some extent, even with download culture, is that bands need to get out there live and build their audience. Certainly it was truer back then because you didn't really have the internet as full-blown as we do. And he was obviously out there touring and things, but it's really interesting how he kind of had to build and augment the band as he went along, because obviously the sometimes the equipment would fail, with the playing the bits of backing tracks and stuff. So the live sound came out of that, and I think he talks a lot about how they toured really hard all the way through until 1991-92, and then the Broken mini album / EP came out. So that's a really long period from the release of the debut record and then loads of touring. And I think that sort of paid off in terms of them being a really, seasoned, experienced group, on stage. But like you say, he kind of entered into that really strong work ethic of covering all those bases at once and having lots of creative control and having a really clear direction in his mind of where he wanted to go. And that's where I think the clash came with Gottlieb, because Gottlieb's sort of this won't sell, it's not quite commercial enough. And because Trent was doing something that bit different, that bit new, it wasn't synth pop, it wasn't pure industrial as we know it then, that it was harder to see the true potential of where it could go. I'm sure he didn't necessarily know this himself, but I think touring is the way to, certainly at that time, touring is the way to make it happen. And off the back of that, that attracted loads of other people in the future to him.
Absolutely. And the one gig that we didn't mention from that cycle of touring was Lollapalooza in 91. This was the first Lollapalooza tour, headlined by Jane's Addiction. Mm. Featuring Living Color, the Butthole Surfers. It's very much one of the legendary tours of the early 90s, and really, I think, gave Reznor and Nine Inch Nails a big platform and a lot of credibility. But let's hear a song from Broken. This is Happiness and Slavery. Was a song off the Broken EP called Happiness and Slavery, which references obviously his interest in S&M sexuality, but also his relationship with Gottlieb. And he uses that term slave frequently. And And the sound is very obviously a clear break from Pretty Hate Machine, which some people have called, you know, a dirtied up Human League. I remember when, as a teen, when I bought that EP, I was expecting something like Ministry's Land of Rape and Honey or Skinny Puppy based on the buzz I was hearing about Nine Inch Nails. And when I got my hands on it, I was massively disappointed, although I found myself, you know, playing it a lot to my friends. It was a good party record, but it was not the, you know, vicious noise machine I was craving at the time. And Broken, on the other hand, I think went a long way to restore his credibility in that. But it's not something he did in a calculated way, unless he was maybe calculated to piss off Gottlieb. But he actually had to record that EP in secret to keep Gottlieb from interfering with it. And then meanwhile, a guy named Jimmy Iovine with Interscope Records is calling Gottlieb every day trying to get Reznor's contract.
Yeah, it's a really weird time, isn't it? And so, like, it was a natural thing to break with Gottlieb and TVT, you know, to almost go to anyone. But like Jimmy Iovine, you know, Interscope, really strong record, loads of financial backing behind him. And it obviously, it, given the fact that he was so doggedly pursuing Reznor, you get the sense that, you know, he would have given a lot, a lot can switch over. And it's fascinating because Iovine obviously saw the wealth of potential in Reznor's future recording career. And it's amazing because he couldn't necessarily have, I don't know, off the back of that, those two records, you know, he couldn't necessarily foreseen what was to come, which is like a really great, you know, really great credit to him to give Reznor that opportunity and support him so much. And that's the thing with Gottlieb, the issue around creative control, as you say, he said, Reznor said the ongoing lawsuit, which I think actually, you know, was drawn out for quite some time, added so much pressure and stress and made him quite depressed and angry. And a lot of that actually filtered through into the Broken record. And there's these crazy things about with, you know, on the LP version, there's like something in the Run Out Groove about like, eat your heart out, Steve, or something. And then in like the credits, it's like something like, oh, I can't remember now. It's like big thanks to, big no thanks to this person. You know who you are. Like, it's almost like, you know, obsessive serial killer type territory. Like, I will get you one day. But for now, I'm just going to keep making my music and these veiled, strange non-threats that in like slightly passive aggressive language. So yeah, it really did seem to eat him up inside. And obviously making the jump to Iovine and recording the Broken EP in secret, it just gave him actual creative freedom, which is what he felt he needed to go somewhere.
And Iovine cut a win-win-win deal ultimately, although I'm sure Reznor wouldn't like the idea, but Gottlieb got half the publishing and the proceeds, not just from Nine Inch Nails' future records up through the end of the 90s, but, you know, Reznor's deal with Interscope was the creation of a new record label, Nothing Records, which, you know, he signs Marilyn Manson and has massive success with that. And Gottlieb got half of all that as well. So it was a very expensive situation for Reznor. You know, he got what he wanted, which was the freedom to create. And let's talk about the way they promoted Broken through video and their struggles to get the videos that they made to promote Broken seen by an audience.
Yeah, that was a really strange situation. It's interesting, you mentioned early on about the different producers that Reznor was keen to work with. And when you actually hear the bands play back to you, it's kind of like, okay, this is perhaps the sort of DNA of Nine Inch Nails. And the who's who element of that, you know, includes an essential act, Coil. So, you know, Peter Sleazy Christopherson, formerly of Throbbing Gristle, you know, his presence in Coil and as a video director as well. And obviously his background in, I've completely forgotten the name now, the company that did the artwork for Pink Floyd.
Hypnosis.
The designer.
Yeah, it's Hypnosis. Not to be confused with the company that's buying up everybody's publishing rights now, which was named after the as a tribute of, in some bizarre way, to the graphics company. But go ahead.
Okay. But no, thank you, because it is important. And so, yeah, you know, the connection with Coil and stuff, he got Peter Christopherson in to direct a few Nine Inch Nails promos from around that time. And what's crazy is, like, Reznor, you know, he's a big sort of like slasher movie horror fan from things like the Hellraiser films and the books as well. And, you know, even just going back to, the slasher films of the 80s, he was really keen to work with someone like that, who was willing to push the envelope a little bit. You know, Coil, such a strange experimental group and really on the alternative fringes of what could be defined as music. Reznor, you know, did some film work with them, and you'd think you'd just have a series of straight videos for some of the songs off of Broken. Because if I remember rightly, Broken, because it was kind of like an EP thing, I don't think there was actual singles, but there were videos in support of the music. So it's another way to get it out there. And people obviously go and buy the EP anyway. And they ended up collating, you know, three or four videos into what became known as the Broken movie, somewhat notoriously. And this was basically a kind of unshowable film reel of the videos, and then intercut with some strange sort of narrative around someone who kidnaps someone and then takes them away and tortures them in a really graphic, violent, brutal, cruel, demeaning ways, based upon the film Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, which is actually about a real guy.
Who lied about all his crimes, but that's an aside.
Oh, sure. He killed loads of people, but...
people, but it turns out that he probably didn't, and the police were using him to close up cases they couldn't solve. So anyway, but that's an aside. But and the Broken film... I remember that was being passed out bootleg copies on VHS, the same trading network that was trading things like, you know, the Frank Zappa groupie who did horrible things with a flute, or Chuck Berry violates fans in utterly disgusting ways. And so it was stymied because it was very hard for him to get it released. It's not the kind of thing that they would sell at Walmart or whatever, but it was out there, and it sort of added to the buzz about Nine Inch Nails in my perception and the credibility. But
yeah.
And I want to break real quick to hear from our sponsors. And when we get back, we'll actually start talking about the creation of the Downward Spiral. And so he's at a point where he's secured his freedom, essentially, or enough freedom to make the music he wants to make. He's been touring for years. He's broken up with a longtime living girlfriend. He's essentially homeless, although he's got plenty of resources. Tries living in New Orleans and looks for studios to record. For whatever reason, he ends up leaving New Orleans to go to Los Angeles. The story is he saw 15 different houses in one day, picked one. And then he gets a mailer advising him, you know, this disclaimer that the law requires them to send it out, that there was this horrific series of murders committed in the house, or one horrible night of murders. And it's not just any murder. This is the Manson family. This is the Sharon Tate house, where members of the Manson family murdered Sharon Tate and J.C. Bring, the celebrity hairdresser, and Wojtek Frykowski, and Abigail Folger, the Folger's coffee heiress, and as well as a kid that just happened to be in the driveway at the time. And so it's this, you know, one of the most notorious sites in U.S. history. And obviously, given Reznor's background and pre-elections, you want to, it's just strange credulity to think he didn't know that was the house. Although it's also entirely plausible if he's, you know, in a hurry and he's looking at 15 houses in one day, he doesn't know his way around L.A. and the house obviously doesn't have big signs on it. So, but anyway, he finds himself in this infamous house that's now been demolished. I think he was one of the last residents of the house, but spending $11,000 a month to live there and record. And from the get-go, the project is behind because, you know, it's supposed to take a month to build a studio. It takes 3 months because Reznor decides he needs to learn how to build a studio himself. He's got professional help, but, you know, he's in there. And the portrait of Reznor that comes through is one of just an absolute workaholic. I mean, he's spending a minimum of 14 hours a day working and living there in the house. He says he hates L.A. He never goes out, never meets anybody. So it's basically him and a handful of collaborators, you know, working on this. Flood Ellis is back. His sound man, whose name is Sean, starts with a B.
Bevins,
yeah, is there. And initially, he offers his guitarist the opportunity to contribute songs to the record, but that doesn't work out at all. And in fact, writes a song called Piggy about Richard Patrick after that falling out.
Yeah, it's a weird origin story. I think that I think from what I've read and researched, I think the Richard Patrick story is perhaps the most credible. And I think obviously because the song is a weird kind of like for me a weird kind of meld of like relationship breakup and almost kind of like an alternative I Will Survive in terms of I think it's the second moment on the album where the line "Nothing can stop me now" is introduced and actually closes the track. And it's this weird vibe of, you know, going through the breakup of an emotional connection with someone that might not be necessarily, you know, a sexual relationship. And it's it could be a close friend, someone like Richard Patrick, long-term collaborator. And it's a really weird story because you think how close these guys were. And in essence, the way Patrick tells it is that John Malm, the manager of the band, was sort of saying, look, you know, maybe you should go down the road, get yourself a job, pizza delivery place, keep yourself ticking over while we're doing the record. So he was already kind of like, almost like kind of being nudged away, felt quite disassociated from the process. And what he learned was, you know, if he was chipping in pieces of music, he wouldn't necessarily see any royalties from that process. He wouldn't necessarily be credited. He would just be, as the songwriter, he would just be another musician who happened to perform, you know, within the songs as if he was playing a gig. And I think he felt really disenfranchised by that and perhaps slightly betrayed. So he went off to go and start the band Filter and had, you know, good success with that. And I think in some ways I got the impression that Reznor actually kind of encouraged him to go and do his own thing. And it was perhaps a sense of, because it was quite a one-man show and Reznor needed people to do X and Y as and when he needed them to, as you can get an engineer or a producer or something to, you know, help you fulfill your vision, the idea of an extra guitarist, unless they're going to lay down some amazing solos or something, you know, they're not strictly necessary to the process. The reason for the term Piggy apparently just comes from a sort of nickname that got bandied around in soundchecks and stuff. And it's that weird sort of connection with the Lord of the Flies culture where, you know, in the film, I'm sorry, in the book, William Golding's book, he's the weaker, more vulnerable character who's sort of exploited. So I don't know if Reznor actually meant it as a reference to that, but the association still kind of comes through, obviously. And Richard Patrick was just the kind of person who seemed slightly isolated, pushed out of the process, and there wasn't really a place for him anymore. And that's the theory about where Piggy came from. One great thing to mention, you were talking earlier about drumming. I think that's Reznor's only, as far as we know, recorded performance on drums. It's only an excellent one where he basically creates the, you know, the outro of the song and just tried to go as wild as he could on the drums. And it's really weirdly together, slightly sort of falls apart, the rhythm kind of collapses, but it's also sort of on purpose, and he kind of lets it happen and just goes with it and then kind of brings it back and then, you know, brings the song to a close with the big bass hits and the crashing cymbals and stuff and the "Nothing Can Stop Me Now" line. So it was actually an amazing drum performance, especially as he makes it into something slightly weird, slightly avant-garde and experimental, but still actually keeps it all together.
And let's go ahead and hear a little bit of that drumming from Piggy by Nine Inch Nails.
Nice.
And that was Trent Reznor playing drums on the song Piggy, which was not dedicated to, but perhaps about his relationship with Richard Piggy Patrick, who tried to resist the nickname. Nobody wants to be Piggy from Lord of the Flies. But one of the other collaborators that came in was Adrian Belew, the legendary hotshot session guitarist and member of King Crimson. But Belew is somebody who played on David Bowie's Berlin period albums, particularly Low, which is one of the lodestars for this album, one of the signposts that Trent Reznor followed very much. Can you talk about a little bit? And obviously Reznor would go ahead and collaborate with Bowie, but one of the things I thought was fascinating was sort of the self-fulfilling prophecy of being fascinated with somebody like Bowie in that period, because that's when Bowie had become, he'd lived through the Thin White Duke phase of maximum cocaine use, maximum isolation, maximum celebrity. I mean, you know, got so whacked out of his mind and so obsessed with the occult and Nazis that he's photographed Sieg Heiling people coming out of a limo and weighs about 9 pounds and is living on milk and limes, I think. And
peppers,
yeah, green peppers and milk, and yeah, that will keep you from getting scurvy, but not much else. But you know, then he goes to Berlin and records a series of albums, produces 2 Iggy Pop albums, and cuts 4 albums on his own. And Reznor ends up in that same boat where, after, you know, up to this point, he'd been very available to fans and very excited to have fans, but not only is the self-loathing that you mentioned becomes introduced, and it's not there on the first album. The first album is, I'm coming from these bleak circumstances, but I can get through this. But by the time of Broken, and especially the Downward Spiral, he's really not liking himself. And you have to think that the life of hedonism, of being a traveling rock and roller, contributes to that. What's your take on that sort of hall of mirrors, you know, I got everything I wanted and it's living hell phenomenon?
Yeah, it's a really weird contradiction, isn't it? I think it's the, as you mentioned earlier, like the kind of the grind of the touring process actually wears Rockstars down, even though you kind of feel you're having a great time and like this is the best things can ever be, and you know you probably are to some extent, but you're completely disconnected from everyday reality that everyone else is living, which is, I guess, kind of why they're at the shows. But you know, it's that Pink Floyd The Wall element where you know, the character Pink is just in his own little bubble and kind of allowed to bounce around in this strange unreal universe and go crazy. And you know, it's the fact that like when you're touring, you're constantly moving, you never stay anywhere, you don't stay anywhere that comfortable, you're not settled, hard to build up meaningful relationships. So obviously casual sex, I'm sure, is freely available, give or take, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything. And obviously the ways in which people like you or let's say care about you is fleeting, and it's built upon the image of the persona as well. They don't really know you. They're kind of in love with you on stage, or maybe even just the music, and you happen to be connected to the music. So I think those things kind of grind musicians down, along with, like, if I'm maybe so boring, like, you know, bad diet and obviously drug intake and not enough sleep and things like that. So you're kind of just car crashing in a lot of hedonistic musicians' lives. You're kind of car crashing from gig to gig. So, like, the show's amazing, but, you know, you're not doing anything else. You're not paying your bills. You're not keeping anything together in the normal sense. You might happen to make some music along the way. And that's kind of it. You're just going hand to mouth, so to speak. So there's a slight sort of, I think, desperation to that, which could unsettle, you know, many sensitive individual. But it's just the fact that, you know, along with that, Reznor's using past experiences from his life to reflect upon his views on, you know, religion and relationships and things like that. And that obviously informs the content of the Downward Spiral. And once you get into that kind of negativity, the you know, the trajectory is often negative, and it doesn't necessarily go anywhere. It's like nihilism in itself. It doesn't really have an end. It's sort of as far as you can take it, to the point at which you can take no more. So yeah, I think he kind of got himself stuck in a situation mentally from which there wasn't any clear way out but to keep on going.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up Pink Floyd, because, you know, we've talked about his new wave influences and his industrial influences, but arena rock, you know, as a Midwesterner who grew up in the 70s and 80s, Reznor, of course, was exposed to and loved Kiss, Alice Cooper, and Pink Floyd, you know, who would come through with these epic spectacles of, you know, The Wall and Animals and that sort of thing. And so Reznor's live shows were very much influenced by that sort of strain of 70s theatrical rock. And it was, you know, a fusing of influences. And the timing of this record's release, it's long delayed. And then the record biz press, you know, there was a lot of tut-tutting about, you know, Iovine's wasting his money. And, you know, there was rumors of drug abuse and, you know, anytime you give somebody unlimited money and time, you have the risk it's going to turn into Axl Rose and Chinese Democracy and take 20 years to come out or never come out at all. You know,
the Brian Wilson's album that takes ages to make.
Yes, or Brian Wilson's Smile, which, you know, a lot of people love as a masterpiece, but it took 40 years to officially be released. So, but yeah. Reznor does deliver the goods. The album comes out, does very well right out of the gate, ultimately sells, you know, goes quintuple platinum, sells 5 million copies. And the timing of it is just perfect. It comes out just a month before Kurt Cobain kills himself. And I've spoken with author Adam Caress about the way the record industry seized on that to end the kind of aesthetic free-for-all that had been going on. I mean, you had the record companies were just signing everybody because they had no idea what was going to be popular anymore. There's this huge variety of bands and acts of all kinds that are suddenly massively successful. Hip-hop bands, grunge bands, you know, alternative bands like the Pixies that don't have anything to do with grunge, industrial is happening, obviously. And you know, Reznor sneaks out right in that window before the clampdown comes, and it's only going to be Candlebox and Nickelback and Blur and bands that are exactly like Kurt Cobain that get promoted. And you know, but he's also sort of riding a wave. There's a whole list of bands that you put together that put out these very dark, grim albums around the same time. Alice in Chains' Dirt, obviously, is one. Pantera puts out an album. STP, the Deftones, and you really focus in on the Manic Street Preachers and their album The Holy Bible, and then the fate of Richie Edwards. And you know, to me, it's like Edwards and Reznor are very much parallel figures. They're both pushing it as hard as they can. They produce these works that their fans regard as, you know, this is their ultimate masterpiece statement. But Richie Edwards doesn't come back from it, and Reznor does.
It's a really interesting thing, isn't it? And it's like, on the surface, the two bands actually don't have a lot in common, because it's like Reznor takes a very I think universal, instinctive you know, approach to like big emotions and feelings and kind of human situation, whereas the Manics took a really the opposite, you know, kind of like pop culture and also highly intellectual, very literary, you know, referential kind of path, where it's all about kind of like context and connections and things like that of ideas. So it's weird that those two sort of things, yeah, I think those two things do sort of run quite well in parallel, because as you say, like Richie Edwards and Trent Reznor, they kind of had that like shared trajectory mentality of like questioning what is everything worth, and when you strip away more and more layers, which is what Reznor talked about as the concept for the Downward Spiral, you kind of see that there isn't much there left. And when you run out of things to believe in, it's hard to take I think it's harder to take a positive stand on your life and find value in the future, and to see where, you know, to see where you're going with anything, because what's worth pursuing. And you know, you can say there's like art for art's sake, but if you're deeply unhappy, it's also really hard to get out of bed in the morning and carry on with that, especially if your work itself is on the darker side of things. And it's interesting because like some people don't have any idea about the Manics. So they never really broke America and so on, so it's a weird connection for some people. But you know, the Downward Spiral and the Holy Album, they both have this the Holy Bible.
Some people consider it the Holy Album, but it's
and the Freudian flip, isn't it? It's like, it's one of my favorites. The Holy Bible has that, you know, very stripped back, really harsh, dry, not like rough underproduced aesthetic, but just like very lean, very clean, sort of sound, very post-punk, like Public Image Limited kind of thing. And I think, you know, the Downward Spiral has some of that too, because it's not about necessarily making things sound, once again, really slick and shiny and, as you say, perfectly on the beat and so on. But those two records share this kind of like cadaverous, harsh mental landscape. And what's really rough on the listener, and I think on the two, you know, the two key architects behind those albums, is the when you take on board that kind of mentality, it can be quite it can become quite a dark, gravity inducing sort of situation to put yourself in. But you know, when the record finishes, hopefully you think, you reflect upon that and you say, well, that was interesting and it took me to a certain space, but I enjoyed it. I got something out of it. It resonated with me and I had some cathartic experience. And now I'm going to go on with my life and things. I think what's challenging is sometimes that not the record itself influences people in this way, but it kind of sometimes overshadows people and they kind of carry it with them, which I think, you know, really happened to someone like Edwards and to some extent Bresner, to which they couldn't shake it off. You know, it wasn't just about persona. It was just about, oh, fuck, this really is me. And it's like, what kind of person am I?
Yeah, and so many of his contemporaries, Scott Weiland of Stuntable Pilots, Lane Staney of Alice in Chains, end up ODing, Dimebag Darrell of Pantera is murdered after an ugly interband feud inspires, you know, a fan, somebody thought they were a fan to murder the legendary guitarist. Yeah. And so, you know, and there's this wake of tragedies in the trail of this album, and you can't blame the album, but you know, the Columbine massacre happens in Colorado, and a lot of people do blame music. Marilyn Manson really took the heat from it, but so did Nine Inch Nails. And you've got a quote in here about the album's nihilistic imperative, the empowerment that comes when there's no fixed meaning or higher authority in the universe. And you know, you're playing with fire when you're thinking about ideas like that and you're putting them out there, especially to an audience of young people who are frequently, you know, sort of a self-selected troubled youth coterie in a lot of ways. I mean, that's the cliche, but if you read like Daphne Carr's book about Pretty Hate Machine, where she interviews multiple Nine Inch Nails fans, that's a constant theme that this music spoke to people because they needed it in their lives because their lives were pretty bleak. But I want to turn and talk about the Closer video, because he takes a very different direction after the experience of Broken, where he just did what he wanted to do and creates this video so nobody can see. He works with Mark Romanek and does this video for Closer, which to this day, I still cannot believe was just a staple of MTV at the time, but it absolutely was. Tell us about that video and how that broke through.
Sure. Yeah, it's an amazing like vault fast, isn't it? It's like it's real contrast to what he was doing before. And I you can sort of feel his frustration, because I think like Broken movie was like a real experiment and kind of a fuck you, is like, how far can I push MTV and so on. It's like, oh, they won't show it. The video is weird. The video was never actually, I don't think it was never actually banned. It's just they're like, oh, we're not going to show it. Do you know what I mean? It's like they just wouldn't accept it. It wasn't like an appropriate format and so on. And it was 20 minutes still. You know, when he came to Closer, it was like, okay, let's try and go the other way and let's do something genuinely artistic, but let's try and do it really, you know, not even cliche, the opposite. Let's try and do something really well put together, conceptually rich, really like powerful images still, and still, you know, challenging and evocative of lots of kind of transgressive themes of S&M and so on, and just, you know, let's say violence, like inherent violence and death and so on, and decay, and let's put that out there in a much like shinier sort of presentation with someone who really knows what they're doing and has an amazing track record. So I think even like, you know, the reputation of Romanek was useful to that, but even then they went like really crazy with it. They shot it in digital and they shot it on vintage film stock, I think from the 1920s, so there's, you know, a hand-reeled camera and the stock's really expensive, and if you fuck it up or you wind it too fast, you know, it messes up the recording. So they, you know, they really went to town on trying to do something amazing, and they spent a lot of money on it. And there was a contentious point at which Reznor was saying, you know, that there's an uncensored kind of version, which is a bit more graphic and so on, which I think featured some anatomical illustrations of female and male genitalia, not even in a state of corrosion or infection or anything, just like, you know, this is part of our human bodies. And that was a little bit too much, just because it was sort of on the nose for MTV. And he was like, oh, fuck it. So what, we ended up like making like two versions of the film, you know, like slightly edited and stuff. But what they did was really funny, where they just kind of like, with the Closer song itself as a single, they just kind of like gapped out the swearing of the fuck, and they just kind of put like a censored title card up instead of some of those pseudo graphic images, which were, you know, explicit as in honest and true, but weren't necessarily anything horrific or contentious to people's general sensibilities. So yeah, the video was an amazing achievement, and it really stuck in people's imaginations. You know, there's so many things that I can sort of like reel off the top of my head, which involve like Reznor, where he's like naked and sort of strung up with the ball gag, and then he's like in the wind tunnel, and then he's like being spun from the ceiling. And it's great fun, the video, you know, it's really great fun. It's really visually arresting, and it jumps from thing to thing, and yet also it kind of lingers where it's necessary. Has the wacky little heart sitting in the chair that's being like sort of, you know, pumped away by wires and stuff. There's a monkey on a crucifix. The monkey was not harmed. I think all the listeners will be glad to know. There's just so much like amazing stuff in there. So I think even if you didn't necessarily like the song, which is, you know, it's a really groovy, funk driven song, there was so much like cool stuff you could see in the video. It was kind of a visual feast. So having other people like, oh, we're a band and here's us playing our instruments in a room and being really real, it doesn't really compete in terms of, you know, artistic creation. So that was the great achievement of Closer. It was something really interesting and challenging, but it didn't have to be disgusting or provocative for its own sake.
And let's hear one last song and then talk about the influence of this album on other people. And this is one of the songs that had the biggest secondhand impact. And this is Hurt by Nine Inch Nails.
To see if I still feel, I focus on the pain. The only thing that's real, the needle tears a hole. The old familiar stain.
And that was Trent Reznor's Hurt from the Downward Spiral album by Nine Inch Nails. And that song's probably most famous as a Johnny Cash song. And it was made famous in a video directed by Mark Romanek, who did the Closer video. So, you know, the circle's connected. Rick Rubin produced those Johnny Cash albums and, you know, got Johnny Cash covering Danzig and Soundgarden and so many other artists. And he really had to write the lyrics to that song down on paper to show to Johnny Cash. Johnny Cash couldn't get past the sound of it. And once he got the lyrics and he absorbed it, creates this version that Trent Reznor described as, it was like having your girlfriend stolen. Like, you know, it's very much like the way Otis Redding described Here in Respect once Aretha Franklin sang it, you know, damn, that girl stole my song. Like, you're not getting it back after a performance like that. And that was obviously Johnny Cash's one of his last, I think his last release before he died. And you know, anybody, I remember when I first saw that video, and having been a Johnny Cash fan my entire life, it was this sudden painful realization of, oh my God, Johnny's going to die real soon. And, you know, it's just so powerful. And, you know, and I think it also gives, it validates Reznor's songwriting in a way, because that's the real test of a songwriter, you know, like an Irving Berlin or Paul McCartney, that somebody that, you know, can write a song that it's not just their version, that almost anybody can sing this song and it's still going to have some magic and some power. And when you get somebody like Johnny Cash that can really bring power and life experience to it, it's incredible. But I want to get you to talk a little bit before we wrap up about the other groups that were influenced by Nine Inch Nails. And you break post Nine Inch Nails rock into three categories. You've got new metal, emo, and what you call the new rock revolution. And you bag on new metal, which everybody does, but two out of those three categories did have big Nine Inch Nails influences, and one of them didn't. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's really hard for me to nail down now. Sorry, pun. But I mean, like, it's complicated, isn't it? I mean, the new metal thing, it sort of just came at a weird time for me. At the switch of the millennium and stuff, and I was like, I was just so unimpressed by people like Limp Bizkit and so on. Like, I think you could sort of like give them credit as like a band that had clearly worked hard and stuff, but I just thought their songs and their attitude was so bad. But then you had other sort of like groups that were of that generation. Like for me, like for example, like I really liked Incubus. I think they're actually kind of quite unfashionable now. But I thought, like, you know, the guitarist, like Mike Eisenegger, was amazing, and his use of effects and stuff. So yeah, it really was a mixed bag. And then emo was sort of like one one side of the musical spectrum in the early 2000s. It sort of took over that decade in some ways. There was like, you know, lots of different groups. And I think the one sort of thing they took from bands like Nirvana, Nine Inch Nails, and a lot of stuff that from the 90s was just the ability to be more emotionally open and direct in their songs. And so it allowed for a breakdown of what we would now term sort of the toxic side of masculinity. Not to say that masculinity is in and of itself toxic, because that'd be, you know, damning half the population. But just the, obviously the, you know, the idea that music and lyrics and the persona of the musicians involved has to be aggressive and possessive and controlling and so on, which is the kind of thing you got from Limp Bizkit. You know, they're sort of like their active misogyny and chauvinistic attitudes are just like, yeah.
And yet they adapted that extremity as an aesthetic, and that's the phrase you use in the book. Mm-hmm. They carried that torch from the grunge bands and from Nine Inch Nails and Ministry and others, of just this idea, yeah, of we're going to be as extreme as possible. Whereas groups like the White Stripes and the Strokes and the Hives, that were critical darlings around the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, as you point out, they're essentially a retro movement, and it seems like Nine Inch Nails had no impact on them. And I think that was self-conscious of those groups at the time. They were going back to punk and blues, but it does seem, you know, having done this show for so long and obsessed about music history, that the more retro a group is, even if it's seen at the time as really bracing and powerful, they tend not to have as much of an impact on future groups. And I think that's very clear. You can see where the emo bands, you know, that are very influenced by Nine Inch Nails are then very influential on the SoundCloud mumble rappers, like people like Little Peep and Kodak Black even. And you know, so this kind of extremity and being on the cutting edge, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that goes forward. And we're not really time to go into much of Reznor's post Downward Spiral life, but he does another massive album, The Fragile, which is kind of his sign of the times or whatever, the big epic sprawling masterpiece.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. Yeah.
And then he battles his own demons and falls into addiction himself, and then comes out of it and is a successful soundtrack creator. So there's kind of a happy ending, and he didn't go down the Lane Staley path or the Richie Edwards path, and he found a life and redeemed himself, and, you know, soundtrack work on The Social Network, directed by David Fincher. And also want to mention, he inspired Fight Club, that Chuck Palahniuk wrote that listening to The Downward Spiral. So Adam Steiner, the book is Into the Never, Nine Inch Nails and the Creation of The Downward Spiral. Really had a fun time talking to you.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you. It's really interesting. It's one of those crazy albums where it leads off into lots of mad tangents, which I guess is why it became a book. Thank you very much. And like, I really appreciate your questions.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Steph asked Nate some questions. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com. Code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.